Hello, and welcome to the talking newspaper for St Albans, Harpenden and the surrounding area. I'm Bill, and this is the Red Saturn programme for Saturday, the 20th of November, 2021. I do hope you're all well and staying safe. The music this week is a delightful instrumental piece called Fenland from a well-known folk group called Granny's Attic. I had the honour of introducing them at a concert at the Maltings Theatre last Friday, and they were absolutely marvellous. Finally, after 19 months of little activity and hardly any income, they're back on tour and as good as ever. They'll be performing again in this area at the Kimpton Folk Festival in July. If you're nearby, it's a very worthwhile event if you like this kind of music. They're very happy to allow us to use this track, and I will, of course, play it in full at the end of the show. This week, as usual, we have the news stories and radio listings, and then a rundown of television programmes that offer audio description. This will be followed by part three of the 10-minute set of gentle exercise routines provided to us by TNF Soundings to help keep you moving at home. This episode will be repeated next week. We really hope they'll be of value to you, but if they're not, you can of course simply skip to the next item, which this week is Rupert Evershed's Nature Notes, in which he talks about Tittenhanger gravel pits and their importance as a refuge for wildlife, and how they are under threat of development. Then we have a couple of articles from Hearts Life magazine. The first is about Rothamsted Manor, home of Sir John Bennett Laws, the 19th century scientist and founder of what is today the Rothamsted Agricultural Research Institute. The second article concerns the humble hedgerow and how it could return to pre-World War II levels, thus creating a healthier and more biodiverse landscape. We start with the news, and our readers this week are Caroline, Ian, Elizabeth and Sarah.
Hello, I'm Caroline. And my first story today is entitled, Dad Traumatised After Armed Police Raid His Home by Mistake. A single dad is still reeling from the shock of armed police bursting into his home and holding him at gunpoint in what proved to be a case of mistaken identity. The last thing Eddie Crowdsall, 55, expected to see when answering a knock at the door of his Riverside Road flat on Sunday morning was a squad of police pointing guns at him. He was ordered to stay still and hold his hands over his head. All this time I was covered by rifles pointed at me and very aware of the laser targeters bouncing around my chest and abdomen. Meanwhile, Eddie's 15-year-old son, Jack, who lives with him full-time, was still in his room and was given no opportunity to see him or talk to him. One officer took my hands, put them behind my back and cuffed me. He was interrogated about the whereabouts of someone called Jordan, who he had never heard of, before being escorted out into the street in just his T-shirt and underpants and left to wait for 20 minutes with a uniformed officer, being told to shut up when he tried to find out what was happening. After about 15 minutes, the officer spoke on his radio and then started to ask me about who I was. Then he told me that clearly they had the wrong address and seemed a little embarrassed. Eventually, I was taken upstairs, uncuffed, deposited in my flat, and left alone. I told one armed officer that they'd made a mistake, and he angrily shouted at me that he was just doing his job and implied that in some way it was my fault they'd made a mistake. He soon learned that his son had been woken up by officers pointing rifles at him while he was still in bed, demanding to know if he was Jordan. Eddie was subsequently visited by a sergeant who came to apologise, but he wasn't satisfied. His main interest was trying to convince me that mistakes happen, that I shouldn't worry about it, and that I should see this as pretty normal and move on. He said basic research should have alerted police to the fact that nobody called Jordan resided at his address and he was a single dad living with his son. As you can imagine, this was a pretty traumatic experience, not helped by the aggressive armed officer who refused to accept they were in any way to blame or by the offhand attitude by the officer who spoke to me afterwards. While the incident was going on, I didn't have time to be frightened. I knew I had done nothing and was more worried about my child than anything else. Afterwards, though, I keep replaying the incident in my head, got very little sleep that night and had nightmares when I did sleep. I kept seeing those targeting lasers on my chest and imagining Jack being woke up in his own room by shouting men with rifles. Not only was the incident itself terrifying, and will be for a long time after, but the fact that a large group of armed men can be sent out to terrify innocent people because they couldn't be bothered to do the most basic research and then refuse to listen to the people they've taken, even when it is blindingly obvious they have made a mistake, is absolutely terrifying. A spokesperson for Hearts Police said, "Officers attended Riverside Road just after 8 a.m. Sunday morning following reports that a person in one of the flats was being held at knife point. Due to the nature of the report, armed officers were sent to the scene as a matter of protocol in order to ensure the safety of members of the public and police officers on the scene. As a specific location was not given by the caller, it was necessary to search a small number of addresses to try and quickly locate anyone who may have been in danger and to detain any potential suspects. Public safety is our number one priority in these circumstances, and time was of the essence. Once the incident had been safely concluded, local officers attended to explain the response and provide some reassurance to those living in the area. We remain in contact with one of the occupants to discuss their concerns. We would like to thank residents for their cooperation throughout." And accompanying this article is a photo of Eddie with his hands up and an armed police officer outside his address.
Hello, I'm Sarah, and here are three brief articles. The first is called Kindness in Cotton Mill. In the spirit of their school value of kindness, a St Albans primary school donated hampers to the people in the community. Children at Mandeville Primary School were asked to nominate someone in the cotton mill area who's shown them kindness during lockdowns, and 18 hampers were made by the PTA at the school and given to the selected nominees. They included cotton mill community champion Sharon Linney and Brian and Brenda Gilson, who made fairy houses for children who stopped by their garden during lockdown. Hampers were full of items that parents and children had donated, but also with personalised gifts for the chosen recipients. A number of local businesses also donated to the hampers, including Kestronics, SM & Sons, Costcutter, St Julian's Church, JW Hare, Vesta Launderette, and Goldcrest Motors. Children from the school surprised their chosen nominees with their hamper to celebrate Mandeville's Kindness in Cotton Mill Week. The second of these is rather different. It's called Knife Point Crime. A man who wielded a meat cleaver when he carried out a robbery at a petrol station in St Albans has been jailed for 4 years. Matthew Woods, aged 23, from Hamilton Road in Barnet, was sentenced at St Albans Crown Court on Monday after pleading guilty to robbery, possession of a bladed article, breach of a criminal behaviour order and possession of cannabis. Shortly after 9:10 p.m. on Saturday, September the 4th, Woods entered the Esso garage on London Road and demanded that a female member of staff open the till before producing a 6 to 8 inch meat cleaver. He took cash and left the garage. A police investigation identified Woods as a suspect, and he was arrested in Gloucester last month. Investigator Jacob Smith from St Albans local crime unit said, "Thankfully, no one was hurt during the incident, but this was understandably a very frightening ordeal for staff. I'm pleased that Woods is now off the streets."
Hello, I'm Ian. Shop owner, harebrained road closures are affecting my online business. A security clampdown after road closure keys were allegedly copied and circulated has left couriers unable to access high street shops, a business owner has complained. Darianne Tad, who runs The Dressing Room, said the strict city centre lockdown was jeopardising her ability to fulfil online orders, and that other businesses were complaining too. "Hearts County Council are putting obstacles in our way for us to be able to run our businesses effectively, all for some harebrained scheme of closing this road," she said, "and all with no consultation." The Hearts ad reported last week that a suspected security breach had been detected, with St Albans council officers believing keys to gates, in place to enforce COVID-19 road closures, had been copied and circulated. The gates were found to have been opened without authorisation 21 times in October. Since then, the padlocks have been replaced with combination locks, and the gates are now only being opened for 3 hours per day to facilitate pickups and deliveries. The gates, which we manage on behalf of Harts County Council, are open for deliveries at set times known to our local businesses and their suppliers, said Tony Marmo, St Albans Council's Head of Commercial and Development. Outside of these hours, delivery drivers can park at loading bays located beside the pedestrianised areas. He said one loading bay was around 40 metres from the dressing room and the other was roughly 95 metres away. But Mrs. Tad said the new rules were significantly affecting her online business. "We run a substantial e-commerce business alongside our bricks and mortar business," she said. "At 4:30 p.m. every day, we have collections for our e-commerce parcels from DPD and Royal Mail. Up until last week, we had an agreement whereby the gate would be opened so they could drive down and pick up the collections. Now, that agreement has been withdrawn because of this whole key cloning saga." Mrs. Tad said that a parking bay 40 metres away was not sufficient. "On occasion, we will fill two Royal Mail vans," she said. "We are approaching peak trading times on the calendar, Black Friday, Christmas, and the January sales. I'm not comfortable about couriers having to drag expensive products up the high street. Anything could happen to them." St Albans Council and the City's Business Improvement District, BID, both said BID rangers were on hand to help with collections and deliveries. BID Chair Alison Bairnye said, "Harts County Council changed all the gates to combination locks last Friday, November the 12th. St Albans District Council continues to manage the gates, working closely with BID for access for events and to help meet business needs. We anticipated these changes might impact a couple of businesses and immediately contacted them to offer the assistance of BID rangers to help with parcel collections and large pallet deliveries while they adjust to the changes. But," said Mrs. Tad, "every time the drivers have come to the store, they have said that there was nobody there to help. Whether that's true or not, I don't know, but I can't be running up and down the high street looking to see if there are any rangers. Besides, this is not really a long-term solution, is it? I am running a serious business here. That is just not how a serious business runs, waiting for someone to happen to be there to help with our parcels. Couriers need to have access to our premises. This is all so short-term." Mrs. Tad said she had been offered a meeting with Harts County Council later this week to discuss her situation. Mr. Marmo from St Albans Council said, "We believe the arrangements maintain the integrity of the pedestrianised areas while allowing businesses to carry out their operations successfully during the festive season. We are, of course, continuing to monitor activities and will consider any feedback that we receive along with the County Council." Ms. Bairnie said, "We encourage businesses to contact us should they need interim support and to provide feedback so we can inform Harts County Council and St Albans District Council of business needs as the gate management system evolves." Harts County Council did not respond to a request for comment. And the article is accompanied by a photograph of Mrs. Tad in her shop.
My name is Elizabeth, and my first reading is entitled "Brain Injury Survivor's Family Back New Legislation." St Albans parents whose daughter suffered life-changing head injuries on her way to her school prom are backing a bill to improve the situation for survivors of acquired brain injuries, ABI. Peter and Pauline Freeman's daughter, Nikki, was just 17 when the Ford Fiesta she was driving during heavy rain in May 2010 collided with a tree. After her accident, she was transferred to the National Hospital for Neurology and Neurosurgery in Queen Square and spent a month in a coma in ITU, during which time her classmates at St Albans High School raised £5,000 for the facility. She left ITU on the day of her 18th birthday, barely conscious, unresponsive, and making no purposeful movement, and it was many days before she made her first deliberate move. Peter explained, "We were incredibly fortunate that everything went largely in Nikki's favour. After Queen Square, Nikki spent 11 months in the regional rehab unit at Northwick Park Hospital, effectively starting to relearn everything she had learnt in the prior 18 years. Swallowing, sitting, standing, walking a few steps with a giant baby walker. Nikki underwent further therapy, even attending her school prize-giving that December and walking a short distance to receive an award. She then spent a year at the Queen Elizabeth's Foundation Neuro-Rehabilitation Service in Banstead, where she learnt to do things like dress in something other than jogging bottoms, put on her own bra and tie shoelaces. Her family fought to secure her funding to go to National Star College in Cheltenham, a specialist college for children with severe and multiple disabilities, where she and her friends were filmed as part of the BBC documentary The Unbreakables. Nikki now lives back in St Albans as part of the Camp Hill community, who support her as she continues to rebuild her life and relearn the skills and abilities she lost in just a few moments in 2010. Peter said, "We have always appreciated how much support we received from the hundreds of people involved in Team Nikki and the mission of helping her rebuilding of a life, and realised that our experiences could help make the pathway easier for the next family that had to walk the long and dark road we had."
Festive postbox toppers are back for their fourth year. St Albans Yarn Bombers are busy preparing for Christmas with plans for 82 crocheted or knitted postbox toppers to decorate the city and raise money for charity. Founded by St Albans residents Claire Sutty and Candy Stewart in 2018, the Trail of Woolly Wonders has raised over £64,000 for local charities. Claire said, "I've always loved Christmas, but since starting St Albans postboxes in 2018, it's become an even more special time of year. What started as a modest fundraising event with 23 toppers has been embraced by the people and businesses of the area, and you can feel the excitement building in November. The great thing about St Albans postboxes is that it brings together the whole community, businesses sponsoring, individuals donating, local charities benefiting, bringing a smile to every face. 2021 sees a record number of toppers, a bigger team of volunteers, and we can't wait to see everyone out and about finding them all. From December the 1st, people can follow the trail with toppers across the district, including Park Street, Harpenden, Wheatamstead and Sandridge. Jenny Smith of Digital Gen, who has been involved with the toppers since their inception, said, "It takes around 24 hours of volunteer time to make each topper, and our amazing team of yarn bombers have gone above and beyond this year. So please download the app and get ready for some seriously cheerful, inspired designs." Each postbox has a sponsor, from which this year includes people from all over the globe. One man, based in Chicago, has sponsored the postbox outside his mum's house as a surprise, knowing that they are not able to spend Christmas together this year. In 2019, Jez Levy of Marshallwick-based Opticians Eyes on St Albans first got involved and funded the development of a digital trail, so people can enjoy and discover all the postboxes and easily donate via an app. He said, "The trail has become something that the people of St Albans have come to love and treasure as a fantastic community activity that raises huge amounts of money and makes people smile. Every topper has a QR code which allows people to enter the trail and donate. What's more, once people have the app, they can scan each barcode for a chance to win fantastic prizes which have been donated by local businesses." Organisers say that each year they expect 10% of their toppers to be vandalised. To help combat this, they are urging people to keep an eye on their postboxes and alert them to any issues by dropping a note to Postbox Patrol at stalbanspostboxes.org.uk. This year's charitable partners are Youth Talk, which provides a free confidential counselling service to 13 to 25-year-olds in St Albans and surrounding areas, and Hertfordshire-based charity Advance, that supports families affected by ADHD, autism or a related condition. Chief Executive of Youth Talk, David Barker, is absolutely thrilled to be benefiting from this year's Postbox Toppers campaign. "COVID has presented such great challenges for us all, and demand for our local counselling service has grown exponentially during the pandemic. Young people need us now more than ever before, and we know that with our community behind us, we can continue to be there for the growing numbers of young people who need our help and support. A huge thank you to everyone involved and the creative superstars who make this delightful fundraiser possible, and of course, our local businesses and community for their generous support. Debbie Wood, Chief Executive of Advance, is overjoyed to have been chosen as one of the charities for this year's Postbox Toppers campaign. The past 18 months have been very difficult for us as a charity and the many families we help. Demand for our support is continually increasing, and we are regularly adapting our offer to ensure families and professionals have the tools and strategies they need to support neurodiverse children and help young people to thrive. Funds raised by this campaign will help to keep vital services such as our free helpline and support groups running for the next year. Accompanying this article is a rather fantastic picture of a postbox topper with a giggling snowman next to a pair of legs sticking out of a chimney. I think those legs belong to Father Christmas.
Community rallies round Cotton Mill Centre fundraiser. Residents of Sopwell Ward are gearing up to raise £20,000 for a new community and cycling centre. The long-awaited hub is aiming to gain support from individuals and businesses through a crowdfunder. Michelle McKenzie, chair of the Cotton Mill and Sopwell Hub Group, said, "For £50, people can buy a brick engraved with a family or business name, which will be mounted on walls inside the new building. People who donate early can get other rewards, including free meals from Cosa Nostra or the Cobbled Kitchen, vouchers from cycling shops, Jefferson Crafts or Pots of Art." The groups began campaigning to build the centre in 2018 and contributed residents' ideas to the design. The building features two halls for hire, a community cafe, a quiet and well-being room. There's a changing places toilet, providing accessibility for people with disabilities, wudu washing facilities and sports changing rooms. Chair of the Sopwell Community Trust, Nazir Uddin, said, "Young people barely have any facilities or activities left in the Cotton Mill area. This led us to set up the St Albans Youth Project. We're thrilled that now we will have a purpose-built centre where young people and families can meet safely. The centre includes purpose-built cycle hubs offering bike servicing, hire, repairs and reconditioned cycles at affordable prices. Outside, in addition to the existing BMX dirt track, multi-use games area and football pitch, there will be a new cyclo-cross track, a pump track and inclusive programme of cycle training sessions coordinated by the Cycle Hub. St Albans Council and Verulam Cycling Club have raised over £2 million for the centre, which is being built on the site of the former Marlborough Pavilion, off Old Oak on Cotton Mill Lane. Building costs have risen substantially since the original plans, and St Albans District Council has asked the community to raise the last £79,000 for the building. Chair of the Sopwell Residents Association and member of the Cotton Mill and Sopwell Hub, Janet Charles, said, "We urge people to look upon our crowdfunder and help us pass the final challenges of getting this centre built. Personally, I'm looking forward to seeing everyone over a cuppa in the community cafe when it's all done." To support this venture, go to www.cottonmillandsopwellhub.org.
Chamber Awards return as live event post-COVID. The flagship event in the St Albans Business Community's calendar has returned to a live event after being held virtually last year. The 12th annual St Albans District Chamber of Commerce Community Business Awards took place at Chewenbury Farm Hotel last week. The ceremony was presented by Chamber Director Paul Rosenthal and offered a platform to celebrate local individuals and businesses, from young achievers and innovators to green champions and leaders. This year's winners were Joe Fisher, Young Employee, JPA Workspaces, Sustainability, Lussmann's, Best Restaurant, Debenhams Otterway, Excellence in Customer Service, Midnight Blue Marketing, New Business, Raiden Solicitors, Business Growth, and Alistair McMillan, Business Leader, with Team Forge being the recipient of the prestigious President's Award for an outstanding contribution and exceptional commitment to our community. Paul said, "Every year we are overwhelmed by the inspiration and talent from the individuals and businesses within the St Albans district. Thank you to everyone who joined us for our award ceremony at Chewinbury Farm Hotel. It was such an inspiring evening, demonstrating yet again what a fantastic place St Albans is to do business." President of the Chamber, Pat Strodd, said, "The St Albans and District Chamber of Commerce Awards evening was such an uplifting event. The atmosphere and goodwill throughout the room towards all the finalists was amazing. The videos and Paul's hosting will be something that we will remember for some considerable time. Judging in every category this year has been extremely difficult because of the high calibre of nominees." Chamber Events Manager Annan Vinitico added, "This year, when we were finally able to meet again in person, celebrating the contribution of local businesses to the district felt more important than ever. We are fortunate in St Albans to have such a thriving and active business community, and we look forward to seeing this grow now that more people are choosing to work here." The Chamber would like to thank sponsors Buncombe Rum, Sustainable St Albans, the Malting Shopping Centre, St Albans Bid, HSBC UK, Babbel and Rayner Essex, without whom the entire awards process would not be possible. And the article is accompanied by several photographs of the revellers of the evening and a close-up of the irrepressible Paul Rosenthal in full presentation mode.
Can you help family of girl recovering from brain tumour? A crowdfunding campaign has been launched to offer financial support to the family of a St Albans girl undergoing treatment for a brain tumour. Sarah Khalid, age 11, a Year 7 pupil at St Albans Girls' School, was unexpectedly diagnosed with the life-threatening condition after visiting her GP as she wasn't feeling herself. Following a scan, she was taken into hospital for an emergency operation and is now recovering at Great Ormond Street Hospital. Friends of the family are trying to help them through this difficult time by aiming to raise £5,000 in support. Unfortunately, their journey looks likely to continue for a long time to come, and she may still have to undergo radio and chemotherapy. A message on the Just Giving page said, "Sarah is a bright young girl who has an amazing future ahead of her if we can help take the financial burden off the family whilst they all adjust to her ongoing needs. It would mean so much to them all. Literally every penny helps." Stacey Turner, founder of mental health awareness charity It's Okay to Say, is helping raise awareness of the campaign. "This little girl and her family need all the support we can muster, and we're so good for that here in St Albans. We're a brilliant community. Please give whatever you can to the Just Giving page. Even if it's a little, it all tots up. No gesture of help is ever too small." It's Okay to Say has offered full mental health support for the entire family if they would like it now or in the future. "I'm sending all my love and support to Sarah and her family. Sharing is powerful, so please share this far and wide for Sarah. By doing so, it also acts as a huge hug for the family." Sarah's mum, Zahid Khalid, said, "Everyone has been so kind. Thank you for your support." And there's two photographs of Sarah, one obviously just after she's had the operation and she's still got a breathing tube in her nose, lying down, obviously fast asleep and with a teddy, and then another one sitting up in bed with a big smile.
MP shocked by extent of GP shortages crisis across the district. St Albans GPs are overworked and close to burnout due to the ongoing shortage crisis, it has been revealed. A practice business manager at the Lodge Surgery on Normandy Road, which currently serves approximately 20,000 patients, was speaking to MP Daisy Cooper about her concerns. Liz Richards said in the last 2 months the practice had seen 6 members of staff resign, including receptionists, healthcare assistants and GPs, all of whom cited abuse and workload as reasons. The practice currently has multiple half-day sessions a week without any GP to service them, owing to the lack of staff. She said, "All our staff members, from GPs to receptionists to registrars, have been working incredibly hard over the past 20 months, but many are burning out. We have 5 registrars here at different stages of training, and I know some of them are already wondering if being a GP is the right path for them. They're in an environment where they see us all stretched to the limit, overtired and not taking breaks. It's hardly luring them into the profession. The government keeps saying it wants more GPs, but yet they keep putting out negative messaging about those who work in general practice, which the media then gets hold of and amplifies to the general public. It's completely counterproductive towards building numbers of qualified GPs, and it's a huge worry to me and many others in healthcare. Liz told Daisy that the surgery normally takes more than 500 calls a day, with yet more trying to get through on the phone lines. The surgery's online service, Online Consult, in which patients can report minor symptoms and receive a reply within 72 hours for non-urgent conditions, has also been in demand. GP partner Rania Bathia moved out of her home for 3 months during the height of the pandemic to make sure she didn't infect her family with COVID. She said, "Everyone here goes beyond what they're required to do, but it still doesn't feel like enough. We want to do our absolute best by our patients, even if it means working many hours of overtime and finishing admin at home late at night. But we're people and patients too. It feels like the media and some members of the public have forgotten that." Daisy Cooper said, "I already knew that we had fewer GPs in St Albans than we did 5 years ago, but my visit to the GP practice was a real eye-opener. Over the past 20 months, everyone's lives have been put on hold, and many are understandably frustrated at not being able to get a timely GP appointment for themselves or a loved one, especially for conditions that may have been going on for some time. But I can see that staff at GP's surgeries are also hugely frustrated. NHS-wide shortages mean that GP practices are often spending hours chasing hospital letters or reports for their patients, which their patients expect them to already have. And the drive to tackle hospital waiting lists means that those patients who miss a hospital phone call or appointment through no fault of their own often end up back with their GP having to start the referral all over again. Whilst these system failures are utterly infuriating, and I will keep telling the government that too, it's becoming increasingly clear that we will all have to play our part if we are to keep the community GPs and other healthcare professionals we have, who are battling these maddening systems and tackling the treatment backlog every day. I've already called on the Health Secretary to dial down his anti-GP rhetoric, get the professionals around the table and put a real plan in place to tackle the NHS-wide staff shortage that is crippling our health and social care systems. But the frustrations of local residents and GPs alike are palpable, and I will keep pushing for bolder action. In the meantime, residents can always go to their community pharmacies for help and advice with minor ailments. The range of clinical services provided by community pharmacies has expanded significantly in recent years, with even more NHS services being provided by them from this year.
Forward-thinking foodies, a look at sustainable and carbon-neutral restaurants. In the wake of discussions about climate change at COP26 in Glasgow, local restaurateur André Lussmann has announced ambitious plans to be carbon neutral by the end of 2023. André, who founded his eponymous restaurant group 20 years ago on principles of sustainability, has 4 restaurants in Hertfordshire, including St Albans and Harpenden. "I'm very pleased that COP26 has brought issues of climate change into mainstream conversations," he said. "Obviously, this subject is very close to my heart. I've modelled my business on sustainability for the past 2 decades, but I'm always very aware that I don't want to preach. However, I feel I should talk about this crucially important subject and my aim for carbon neutrality." Lussmann's has already won numerous industry awards for its sustainability measures, which include ethically sourcing its food. It is a founding member of the Sustainable Restaurant Association, the SRA, and one of a limited number of restaurant groups currently in the UK to be completely MSC friendly, a kite mark from an organisation which exists to protect oceans and to safeguard seafood supplies for the future. Lussmann's energy is green and renewable, and its packaging is all compostable. When it launched its food-to-go service in the lockdown period, it opted for fully recyclable packaging, even though with more than 500,000 meals delivered, the non-sustainable route would have been considerably a cheaper option. "Every choice we make as individuals does affect the environment," said Andre, "and this extends to which businesses we choose to interact with. If you choose to eat out at a sustainable restaurant, you know that you're doing your bit to combat climate change, albeit in a small way. This includes the mucky subject of dealing with waste ethically. Lussmann's recycles all of its waste, so none goes to landfill. Most is recycled by being anaerobically digested, which produces fuel to heat homes. However, the restaurant group is also donating waste to a number of scientists and research bodies, including the Rothamsted Enterprises in Harpenden, which is conducting research looking into deriving bioplastics from restaurant waste. Local independent brewery and pub group Far Brew agrees that sustainable practices are crucial in 2021, and it also disposes of its waste sustainably. "Our waste water is used as fertiliser on the farm in which our barn sits, and our waste hops are used by local community ventures as mulch and composting material," said founder Nick Farr. "Our waste grain is also used by the local farmer to feed his livestock, which makes up part of our menu in several sites, and we think it's important to help community projects where we can, and local food gardening organisations." Far Brew, which has 6 pubs across Hertfordshire and Bedfordshire, as well as the brewery, also ensures its packaging is 100% recyclable and sources as locally as possible. "Our hops are predominantly British varieties, and the honey used in our beer is produced by the bees flying around the barn where the microbrewery is in Wheathampstead," said Nick's business partner, Matt Elvidge. "It's just always felt right to use local produce wherever possible, but now we know so much more about the issue of climate change and the contributing factors to this, we should all be doing whatever we can to run our business sustainably. We should all be looking at the energy we use, our packaging and our waste." New vegan takeaway business Mungo's Kitchen launched a few months ago in lockdown, and being eco-friendly is a key part of its ethos. "All of our packaging is compostable or made from recycled paper, even the smoothie cups and straws and stickers. Sugarcane pulp packaging is great because it can go straight into the food waste bin to be composted," said Mungo's Kitchen founder and chef, Mark Flanagan. "We've also carefully picked out the most eco-friendly suppliers who use a minimal amount of packaging and source products from as locally as possible. And we buy organic where we can, as that eliminates the number of chemicals used to grow the crops, as these are damaging to our ecosystem." However, the biggest sustainable tick for Mungo's Kitchen is the fact it offers vegan food. "We've known about the health benefits of a vegan diet to the individual for some time," says Mark, "but now we're learning more and more about how good it is for the environment. In fact, recent research suggests that eating a vegan diet could be the single biggest single way to reduce your environmental impact on Earth, and being carbon neutral has become the latest buzzword for being sustainable. But what does this really mean, and how achievable is it? Put simply, it means that you reduce the net amount of carbon dioxide you're responsible for releasing into the Earth's atmosphere, which of course is very damaging," says Andre Lussmann. "What we're now trying to do is to look at our whole business holistically and make sure that we're doing everything within our power to create a net zero carbon footprint. For example, beef production is one of the biggest carbon footprint culprits, so some time ago I reduced the beef options on our menu from 4 to just 1, and this has made a huge difference to our footprint." Lussmann's future objective is to be one of the UK's first completely carbon-neutral restaurant groups, and the first one in Hertfordshire by the end of 2023, which is a challenging target, especially after the battering the hospitality industry has taken over the last 18 months. "We have to be ambitious though, don't we?" added Andre. "After all, there is a clock ticking here, and there is no more important issue on the planet."
Boys Minecraft Challenge in aid of diabetes research. A pair of schoolmates are embarking on a 12-hour gaming challenge for charity. Best friends Arlo Fitter-Clark, 10, and Zach Powell, 11, who both attend Garden Fields JMI, somehow managed to persuade their parents to let them play their favourite game of Minecraft for 12 hours solid, from 12 p.m. to 12 a.m. on Saturday, November the 20th. They are setting themselves the challenge of creating a new world from scratch in survival mode and beating the Ender Dragon. Arlo and Zach are raising money for JDRF, who fund research into finding a cure for type 1 diabetes and also support people living with the condition after Arlo was diagnosed in August. Arlo's mum, Sarah Clark, said, "It's been a life-changing diagnosis for us all. There are multiple daily insulin injections and constant monitoring of his blood sugar levels. Arlo has to be aware of his food and insulin intake at all times. He can't go for a bike ride, play football, or even go to sleep without making sure his levels are safe or acting to make sure that they are. It's quite a lot for a 10-year-old to deal with, but he's been an absolute legend and is coping better than the rest of us. Thankfully, we recognise the signs of diabetes really early, notably extreme thirst, and this meant he never got dangerously ill, but many people end up in ICU on diagnosis. Zach and all of their friends have been brilliantly supportive of him, learning about what it all means for Arlo and helping him manage the condition, and being generally awesome mates. November is Diabetes Awareness Month, so as well as raising money, the boys want to spread the word about the condition, how to recognise the signs, and to share that living with type 1 is really hard work to manage, but that you can still live your life exactly how you want to. Considering Arlo spent a large chunk of his summer holiday this year in hospital, it seems fair that the challenge is also fun. The boys have already smashed their £250 target and raised over £1,650. And the article is accompanied by a photograph of said Zach and Arlo at the controls of Minecraft.
Join the Light Up a Life service at Grove House. Rennie Grove Hospice Care invites you to Light Up a Life in memory of a loved one. The special service takes place on Sunday, November the 28th at 4 p.m. at Grove House, Waverley Road, St. Albans. For those unable to attend, the service will also be available online. There is also the chance to sponsor a light in memory of a loved one or write an online dedication to celebrate the life of a loved one. Among the readings, music, poems, a moment for reflection, and the Christmas tree light switch on, Jane Russell, wife of former Rennie Grove patient Steve, will speak about her experience of losing a loved one. Jane said, "For me, taking time to reflect on happy memories is so important. Light Up a Life gives people an opportunity to do that in a caring, supportive, understanding atmosphere alongside other people who have been through something similar. It would be lovely to come together to celebrate the lives of the people we miss and love so much." The service will be recorded and will be available to watch at www.renniegrove.org/LUAL from December the 5th until the end of the year.
In the footsteps of St Albans' first female superstar, Sarah Churchill, Dowager Duchess of Marlborough, the wealthiest woman in England, died on 18th of October 1744, aged 84. From relatively impoverished beginnings, she had, through determination and ability, amassed a fortune which today is almost impossible to quantify. Her 27 landed estates in 12 counties would be worth today at least £100 million. She also had other investments worth £67 million in today's terms, part of which were loans to the British government. But she was not just a very astute businesswoman. From 1690 until her death, she was the most talked about and influential woman of her day, a determined politician, courted by all political parties who she never flinched from attacking if she felt they were not acting in Britain's best interests. Indeed, her belief in straight talking made her fall out with many people. Besides being a Duchess of Marlborough, she was a Princess of Mindelheim and Countess of Nellenberg in the Holy Roman Empire, and from 1677 until his death in 1722, the wife of one of Britain's greatest military commanders. Although various roads and schools in St Albans have Marlborough in their title, or in the case of Killigrew School, commemorate people she knew, there is little to make visitors aware she was a native of St Albans. Sarah, born Sarah Jennings, was baptised in St Albans Abbey on the 7th of June 1660. Her father owned the manor of Sandridge. Although historians disagree whether this included the property known as Water End, he also owned Holywell House, demolished in the 1830s and situated at the bottom of Holywell Hill. Dying in debt, his estates heavily mortgaged, he was buried in the abbey before Sarah was 8 years old. In 1673, aged 13, she became one of the maids of honour to the wife of James, Duke of York, later King James II. In her 18th year, self-assured and attractive, she married the young soldier and ambitious courtier, John Churchill. The marriage was opposed by both families due to the couple's lack of wealth, but it was a true love match, and they remained devoted to each other until John's death. While John's army career progressed, Sarah formed a deep friendship with James's youngest daughter, Anne, who relied on her totally during the political turmoil of the 1680s and 1690s. Anne became queen in 1702. The friendship would totally break down in 1711 due to Sarah's outspokenness and political views. Until then, she controlled the Queen. Her husband commanded the army, his brother George, one of the MPs for St Albans, controlled both the navy, and the Queen's husband and their mutual friend Godolphin ran the government. Very rarely has such power been concentrated in the hands of so few people. When George I became king in 1714, John and Sarah regained some of their influence, and it was great enough for Sarah to later play a leading role in opposing Walpole, Britain's first Prime Minister. The Churchills made Holywell House their home in 1684. They renovated and extended the house and, to take traffic away from their front door, diverted part of the road, creating what is now Grove Road. John had the River Ver redirected and laid out extensive gardens with water features between what is now Belmont Hill and the river. Here they entertained their friends and political allies, including Queen Anne. Their associates, such as Admiral Killigrew, acquired property in St Albans. Although they would later possess grander houses, for example Blenheim Palace, to them Holywell would always be a refuge from the world's troubles. Indeed, during her long widowhood, Sarah confessed it had too many happy associations. In 1735 she wrote, "This place is convenient and suits well enough with my inclination, who never was fond of magnificent things, yet 'tis so dismal. To be here alone in a place that makes me reflect upon many scenes of happiness, none of which can ever return, that I cannot bear to stay." Nevertheless, the ability to influence local politicians and ensure St Albans elected MPs sympathetic to the Whig interest was too great an opportunity to miss, and in 1732 she determined to leave a more permanent memorial. She had often helped destitute veterans of Marlborough's campaigns, or their families. Now she had an old manor house on what is now Hatfield Road demolished, and employed the architect Francis Smith of Warwick to raise a noble building for the relief of 40 poor families of the town, and Her Grace will leave a sum sufficient to endow it for ever. The sum she originally set aside was the equivalent of £6 million today. The charity of Sarah, Duchess of Marlborough, still exists for the provision and continuing maintenance of the almshouse in Hatfield Road, St Albans, for the benefit of poor persons of good character and over 60 years of age. On the imposing facade are Sarah's arms as Duchess of Marlborough and Princess of Mindelheim. Like far too many historic buildings in St Albans, there is nothing to explain its importance. The only plaque commemorating Sarah was raised by St Albans and Hertfordshire Architectural and Archaeological Society in 1935 and is placed on the corner of Holywell Hill and Belmont Hill. Is it not time that we did something more?
In this article, St Albans MP Daisy Cooper looks back on a week in Westminster, and it's called Engaging Young People with Politics. Sleaze has overshadowed Parliament for the last couple of weeks, so it was a welcome relief to get out and about to meet children and young people for UK Parliament Week. This is an initiative run by Parliament to get young people feeling engaged, informed and excited about politics. When schools and clubs sign up, they're sent a free kit with goodies including a ballot box, stickers and an activity booklet with a whole host of democracy-related ideas, one of which is having your MP come in and talk with the children. So across 8 days, I visited a total of 9 schools and groups. A Brownies Club in New Greens saw the girls debating some pretty controversial motions, including schools should be open at weekends and all ice cream apart from chocolate should be illegal. I was cast in the role of speaker, and I'm pleased to say the debate was very civil and I rarely had to shout, "Order!" Many older children weren't afraid to confront harder-hitting issues. At Cunningham Junior School, we discussed the climate summit, COP26, and what it should achieve. While at the Woodcraft Folk Club, we had a very in-depth chat about COVID Plan B and the pros and cons of vaccine passports. I was just as impressed with the secondary schools that I visited. Students at Townsend School, which has a thriving debate club, were interested in tips for speech writing and making persuasive speeches in a debate. Parmiter School held a mock election, and over at Stags, we discussed different types of lobbying and why certain parties choose to stand, or not, in by-elections. I'm sure I'll visit many more schools between now and the next UK Parliament Week, but for now, it's great to see another generation of young people discussing the big issues of the day.
Honouring the district's fallen. Hundreds of people gathered around St Albans War Memorial to pay their respects to members of British Armed Forces who lost their lives in 2 world wars and other conflicts. Mayor Edgar Hill led the commemoration and was joined by leaders of the major faiths, representatives of Air, Sea and Army cadets, the guiding and scout movements, the police and other uniformed services. Beside them were Royal British Legion members, honorary aldermen and councillors from county, district, town and parish councils. The Reverend Mark Durnley of St Peter's Church conducted the service, whilst the Reverend Brendan Day of St Alban and Stephen Catholic Church read from the Christian New Testament. Rabbi Daniel Sturgis of St Alban's United Synagogue read from the Hebrew Scriptures, and Mr Akhtar Zeman, president of the St Alban's Islamic Centre, read from the Holy Quran. During the service, there were prayers and the St Albans City Band provided the music for hymns. Wreaths were laid by the Mayor, the Vice Lord Lieutenant Richard Beasley, and representatives of the emergency services. After the service, the Mayor, accompanied by his mace bearer and other dignitaries, saluted a parade of the various groups that attended the event. He said, "It was very heartening to see so many people at our Remembrance Sunday service after we had to cancel last year because of the pandemic. Once again, our community has joined together and turned out in force to honour the many men and women who sacrificed their lives for their country. It was great to see so many young people in particular among the crowds and representing the scouts, guides and cadets. It shows that we all recognise the tremendous debt we owe to the men and women who lost their lives defending our country. We must always remember them." Meanwhile, in Harpenden, a parade took place through the streets of the town before reaching the war memorial for laying of wreaths and a service. Town Mayor Paul Cousin and the High Sheriff of Hertfordshire, Lionel C. Wallace, met and talked to a couple of Harpenden veterans after the service, including Ray, who is 103 years old. And the article is accompanied by various photographs of the remembrance parade and service, and including a close-up of a lady trumpeter.
Shopping centre undergoing major redevelopment work. Major refurbishment work is underway to transform a St Albans City shopping centre into a flagship visitor attraction for the region. Christopher Place is carrying out a huge programme of visual improvements, coupled with measures to help customers enjoy an all-round better shopping experience. As part of the project, the centre mall is being taken up and relaid using the existing slabs to provide a more even surface with cosmetic improvements which will also prevent puddles after rainfall. A membrane is also being laid in between the paving and the ceiling of the car park to make it watertight, enabling the centre to reline and brighten its parking bays. The work will be stopped for the Christmas season, which starts on November the 20th and recommences in the first week of January, with completion in the spring. Centre manager Catherine Morris said, "In 2022, customers will see some wonderful new tenants comprising a good mix of retail and eateries. I won't name them all, as the completion documents are still in working progress, so I don't want to tempt fate. Hopefully, when the mall works have finished, we will be hosting a full programme of activities, as we did pre-COVID." I think most people realise the importance of supporting our high street and would hate it to disappear over time. I have noticed a camaraderie between all retailers in St Albans, pulling together as one team. All businesses are working flat out, making up for trade lost during the pandemic and dealing with the lack of staff issues. It is wonderful to see customers having the confidence to return, and the landlord is showing their appreciation by spending a considerable amount of money on the refurbishment scheme. Since the pandemic, we have really been trying an outside seating area which has a park or garden vibe that St Albans shoppers can enjoy. When all the works have been completed, Christopher Place will be a fabulous place to dine, relax and shop. And there's a photograph of an absolutely thorough mess and a great big red digger.
Now for a look at some of this coming week's radio highlights, starting with Saturday, November 20th. At 4 p.m. on Classic FM, Moira Stewart's Hall of Fame concert features works by Bach, Mozart, Sibelius, Vivaldi, Mendelssohn, Schubert, Carl Jenkins and Elgar. At 5:30 on Radio 4 Extra, in the series Great Lives, the novelist Tracy Chevalier discusses the life of Mary Anning, 1799 to 1847, the working-class woman from Lyme Regis, who in the early 1800s discovered full dinosaur skeletons on Dorset's Jurassic Coast. And on Radio 4 at 10:15, in the series The Reunion, there's another chance to hear Finding Richard III, when Kirsty Walk reunites the archaeologists, scientists and a religious leader and a direct descendant involved in the search for the reburial of Richard III's remains. Sunday, November 21st, Radio 4, 11 a.m, the castaway in Desert Island Discs, is dressage rider Carl Hester, a gold medal winner at the 2012 Olympics. Radio 4 Extra at 1 o'clock, Shark Drunk, details the true story of two friends and their wild pursuit of the Greenland shark. Drama at 3 on 4, The Certificate is Jonathan Myerson's adaptation of Isaac Bashevis Singer's comic novel in a translation by Leonard Wolfe. An awkward Jewish teenager in 1920s Warsaw must marry to obtain emigration papers. Classic FM at 9 o'clock, and the guest on Moira Stewart Meets is global pop star Ed Sheeran, who discusses finding fame, his family connections to classical music, his childhood playing the cello, a piece by Britten, and a recording by cellist Yo-Yo Ma. Finally on 4, at 10 p.m, Radio 4 that is, of course, the Westminster Hour, the political magazine, with Carolyn Quinn. On to programmes then that are broadcast at the same time every day, Monday to Friday, on the same radio station. Same radio station, same time, every day. You know the drill. Radio 4 Extra at 6:30 in the morning, 1:30 and 8:30 each day, you can hear a dramatisation of Agatha Christie's 1950 mystery, A Murder is Announced, with the brilliant June Whitfield as Miss Marple. 9:45 a.m. on Radio 4 all week, and repeated at 12:30, the book of the week is Beautiful Country, Qian Zhuli Wang's memoir of leaving China for Brooklyn, age 7, and growing up as an illegal immigrant. Radio 3 at 12 noon, the composer of the week is Sibelius. Radio 4 at just after midday, and repeated at 10:45 as Book at Bedtime, you can hear the first of 10 episodes of Sorrow and Bliss by Meg Mason, read by Hattie Morahan. As her husband Patrick leaves her, Martha looks back on her bohemian childhood and a bomb that went off in her teenage brain. Still on Radio 4, every day, Monday to Friday, 1:45, a new series of Breakup explores what really happened when the Irish Boundary Commission set out to redraw the border in Ireland almost a century ago, drawing upon original testimonies, secret letters and classified police reports. And over on Radio 3 at 10:45, all week, The Essay, The Weimar Years, in a series of five personal takes on Germany's Weimar Republic, 1919 to 1933. It was first broadcast in 2019. Some of the other highlights then for the rest of the week, starting with Monday, November 22nd. And all of today's recommendations are on Radio 4. So starting at 11, an episode of The Untold called The Dentist Van. Grace Dent hears the stories of people queuing up at a mobile dentist van that's pulled up outside a homeless support centre in Hastings. 2:15 on 4, another chance to hear Writ in Water, a play first broadcast in February to mark the 200th anniversary of the death of the poet John Keats. After a lifetime of illness, Keats is persuaded by his doctors to travel to Italy in the hope the warmer climate will alleviate his poor health. Followed at 3 by Quote Unquote, the light-hearted quiz in which the panel must identify where certain quotations, phrases or sayings come from. And Radio 4 at 8 o'clock, there's the start of a new series, The Wedding Detectives. Wedding albums capture the happiest day of a couple's life, but what happens when those pictures are lost? Wedding album collector Charlotte Sibtan and journalist Cole Moreton uncover the stories behind the photographs and try to reunite them with the families. And finally, on Radio 4, for Monday, 11 o'clock, the first of a new series of Wireless Nights is Bat Night, in which Jarvis Cocker takes listeners on another nocturnal journey through stories of night people, beginning with the world of bats. Tuesday, November 23rd, 11:30 a.m, again on Radio 4, History on the Edge, with the story of a teenage refugee from Nazi Germany who, safe at last in Britain in 1940, was caught up in a deportation policy, ended up on a hazardous sea journey to Australia. Radio 4 Extra at 2:30 for Children of the Enemy, the remarkable story of German children fostered by Dutch families after the Second World War. Back to Radio 4 at 3:30, in the series Costing the Earth, all aboard the Sir David Attenborough goes aboard Britain's newest polar explorer, a ship that will be crucial for research into climate change. 6:30 p.m. on Radio 4 Extra, soul music looks at Billie Holiday's hit 1939 recording of Strange Fruit, in which it's thought to have given a certain impetus to the civil rights movement. And at the same time on Radio 4 at 6:30, there's the first of four episodes in The Casebook of Max and Ivan, in which the writers Max Oleska and Ivan Gonzalez also star as incompetent private detectives. In Community Disservice, Joanna Lumley guests as a washed-up American actress in case of thefts that threaten the future of a community centre. Wednesday, November 24th, 9:30 a.m, Radio 4, Witness. And this week's episode is In Prison with Nelson Mandela, the experiences of anti-apartheid activist Ahmed Kathrada, who was jailed alongside Nelson on Robben Island. 11 a.m. on Radio 4, Could I Regenerate My Farm to Save the Planet? The Herdwick shepherd, James Rebanks, is on a quest to find out if it's possible to adopt the methods of regenerative farming on his farm in the Lake District. The drama on Radio 4 at 2:15 is Episode 3 of Stone. Casualties is a detective tale by Martin Jameson from the series created by Danny Brocklehurst. A young British Asian man becomes a murder suspect, but powerful factors test Stone's team to breaking point. Choral Evensong at 4 on Radio 3 comes from Truro Cathedral. While at the same time on Radio 4, the fourth programme in the series Sideways is Dr. Leach. Matthew Syed makes an appointment with pioneering surgeon Dr. Joe Upton, who in 1985 kick-started a revolution in microsurgery using a centuries-old medical remedy. Yep, leeches. Thursday, November 25th, 11 a.m, Radio 4, in the series Crossing Continents, the programme is Rotterdam and the Cocaine Connection. Linda Presley asks how the Netherlands has become one of the largest illicit drug economies of the world. Radio 4 Extra at 2:30, Caught on Film. Matthew Sweet travels to the festival Il Cinema Ricevato in Bologna to explore the vulnerability of film stock and discovers why many cinematic gems and historically significant documentary films are actually rotting away. Radio 4 at 3 o'clock for Open Country. At Watermead Country Park in Leicester, they've chosen to remember those who lost their lives to COVID-19, the essential workers and everyone who has played their part during the pandemic, with trees planted along a new memorial walk. And there's classic comedy from 1970 on Radio 4 Extra at 7 p.m. with I'm Sorry, I'll Read That Again, with the outstanding John Cleese, Graham Garden, Bill Oddie and Tim Brooke Taylor. Finally, Friday, November 26th, nearly the end of another month. Wow. Radio 4 at 11 a.m, the first in a new series of The Spark. Economist Sam Bowman discusses how building more homes could solve a surprising range of problems and how that could be achieved through a new approach to local democracy. Radio 4 Extra at 2:30, in Blind Date with Don Camillo, Peter White goes in search of his favourite fictional comic heroes from his childhood. There's a pilot episode for a new sitcom on Radio 4 Extra at 5 p.m. about a small English village invaded by aliens. Welcome to Our Village, Please Invade Carefully, stars Catherine Parkinson and Julian Rintutt. And to end the week, political debate and discussion from Slough and Eton Business and Enterprise College in Any Questions on Radio 4 at 8 o'clock. That's it for now. As ever, may I wish you a peaceful, safe and enjoyable week of radio listening.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Here's John's selection of audio-described television programmes for the week commencing Saturday the 20th and ending Friday the 26th of November 2021. Starting on Saturday, with Hugh's Wild West on BBC Two at 10 a.m, Hugh wonders how the people and animals of Dartmoor live alongside each other. There's a rerun of James Martin's Islands to Highlands on ITV at 12:55 p.m. If you missed last Tuesday's DIY SOS, The Big Build for Children in Need, you have a second chance to see it on BBC One at 3 p.m. They're building a purpose-built adventure campsite near Hull. There are a number of game shows on ITV starting at 6:30 p.m. with Moneyball, and then at 7:30, Celebrity Catchphrase, where the celebrities try to win £50,000 for their charity. Lastly, on ITV at 8:30, The Chase Celebrity Special. Can the celebrities beat the chaser to win thousands of pounds for their charity? Did you miss Simon Reeve's new series about the lakes? It is repeated at 6:55 on BBC Two tonight. At 7:55 p.m. on Channel 5 is the last episode of the Madame Blanc Mysteries. Jean prepares to return home, but her plans are disrupted when an intruder slips inside her cottage. Casualty is on BBC One at 9:30. Jan and Fionn are forced together in a terrifying hostage situation. If you would like to watch a comedy film to end your day, there's The 40-Year-Old Virgin on ITV at 10:50 p.m. When Andy makes the mistake of telling his mates that he's less than experienced in sexual matters, they set about helping to remedy the situation. Now on to Sunday, the 21st of November. Let's start with Griff's Great New Zealand Adventure on ITV at 9:30 a.m. Griff starts in the north with a traditional welcome from a Maori chief. This is a repeat of the programme shown last Friday. Then there's some property development in Bury, Gravesend and Newcastle under Lyme, with Homes Under the Hammer at 11:30 a.m. on BBC One. The feature film on ITV at 12:15 p.m. is Small Soldiers, a fantasy action adventure. When a toy designer installs microchips in action figures, the result is a battle royal between the commando elite and the peaceful Korganites. An adventure film, which is on ITV at 2:20 p.m, is Octopussy. A British agent is found murdered and clutching a Fabergé egg. James Bond sets out to investigate and finds himself pitted against the rich businesswoman Octopussy. At 6:10 p.m. on ITV2 is Shrek 2, an animated fantasy. When Shrek and Princess Fiona return from their honeymoon, they stay with her parents. But King Harold is less than enchanted by his new son-in-law, and the fairy godmother has good reason to want the ogre out of Fiona's life. Doctor Who is on BBC One at 6:20 p.m. The Devon village of Medderton is haunted by the Weeping Angels. At 7 p.m. on BBC Two, Hidden Cardiff with Will Millard reveals the development of the Welsh capital from a tiny town to the vibrant city it is today. The second part of The Lakes with Simon Reeves is on BBC Two at 9 p.m. The adventurer looks at the impact of humans on the Lake District, starting with a swim in the crystal clear waters of Buttermere, vastly different from the waters of Derwent Water, which is clogged with invasive weed. Then Simon climbs Scarfell Pike and learns how the ever-increasing footfall of visitors is damaging England's highest peak. Also at 9, but on BBC One, is the fourth part of Show Trial. The highly anticipated trial begins. Now on to Monday the 22nd of November, starting with daytime programmes that are on all week. Homes Under the Hammer on BBC One at 11:15 a.m. Bargain Hunt, which is on BBC One at 12:15 p.m. The Best Christmas Food Ever on BBC Two at 1 p.m, but at 2:25 p.m. on Friday. Doctors on BBC One at 1:45 p.m. This programme is not broadcast on Friday. Escape to the Country at 3 p.m. on BBC One. Nature's Weirdest Events on BBC Two at 4:15 p.m. And, of course, all the soaps are audio described and on their usual channels at their usual times. Gino's Italian Family Adventure on ITV at 8 p.m. Gino and his son Rocco visit the bustling city of Naples. MasterChef The Professionals is on BBC One at 7:30 p.m. The chefs are asked to use classic preparation skills to deliver poussin served on the bone. In part two at 8:30, the chefs have to prepare two signature dishes, a main and a dessert, with a 90-minute time limit. Fake or Fortune is on BBC Four at 8 p.m. The team identify two works from public collections which could be by Gainsborough. Also at 8, there are two episodes of Shakespeare and Hathaway on the Drama Channel. In the first part, Frank and Lou investigate death threats made against a former soap star and in the second part, a workplace compensation claim isn't as clear as it first seemed. On BBC One at 9, The Ouch Laws continues. It's crunch time for Gabby's festival as she and Greg go cap in hand to a possible financier, Gabby's father. On ITV3 at 10 p.m, there's DCI Banks. In this two-hour episode, Dry Bones That Dream, Banks and Morton investigate the killing of an accountant by a hitman. Banks is convinced there must be a vital clue staring him in the face. Now on to Tuesday, 23rd November. At 4:30 p.m. on BBC One, there's a repeat of The Repair Shop. This week, the team restore a child's chair, a musical wedding album, and a mechanical seaside children's ride. Hortby City is on BBC One at 7:50. Max and Dom disagree on a patient's diagnosis, while Ange and Josh try to make their relationship work. On ITV3 at 8, there's another Midsummer Murder in The Oblong Murders. John Barnaby is called in when Lucy Oliver, a member of a New Age cult, the Oblong Foundation, goes missing. You could Love Your Garden at 8:15 on ITV. Alan Titchmarsh and his team make a fabulous garden for Georgie Mosley, the founder of Birmingham's first cancer drop-in centre. Who Do You Think You Are on BBC One at 9 p.m. features actor Joe Sugg. He finds that his seven times great-grandparents fled from religious persecution in France. At 9:15 p.m. on BBC Two, Impeachment, American Crime Story, continues as the pressure increases on Monica. Now on to Wednesday, the 24th of November, starting with Paul O'Grady for The Love of Dogs on ITV at 8 p.m. Paul returns to Battersea Dogs Home. Also at 8, but on BBC Four, Earth, The Power of the Planet, Oceans. Dr. Ian Stewart explores how oceans are thought to have formed from volcano steam and melted comet ice. Shetland at 9 p.m. on BBC One. In this, the final episode of this series, Perez closes in on Galbraith's killer. He struggles with Duncan's secret, and Donna has one more surprise in store. Professor Brian Cox is on BBC Two, also at 9, with part 4 of Universe. Brian continues his exploration with a journey to the supermassive black hole named Sagittarius A, and with the use of computer graphics, takes us back in time to witness the fiery origins of our galaxy's own black hole. There's another DCI Banks on ITV3 at 10 in Wednesday's Child. Banks leads the search for a couple claiming to be social workers who have abducted a boy. On Thursday the 25th, you could start with Some Cookery on BBC Two at 8 with Mary Berry Loves to Cook. Mary meets those who get great pleasure out of cooking for a large number of people. Following on, still on BBC Two, at 8:30, is Nadia's Fast Flavours. Nadia turns her attention to sweet sensations, firstly a custard tart with a creme brulee twist. Then she moves on to shortbread rounds filled with white chocolate and raspberry jam. Sort Out Your Life with Stacey Solomon on BBC One at 8 p.m. Stacey and her team challenged the Dowling family to scale back their possessions in 7 days. The family must part with at least half of their home's contents. As they begin to pack, not much time is spent tidying away toys, but there is a precious item lost somewhere in the house. MasterChef The Professionals at 9 on BBC One. Marcus Waring asks tonight's first two chefs to prepare and cook sea bream. The second two chefs must create crepes served with a chocolate hazelnut spread. Then, 10 p.m. on the drama channel, New Tricks in Left Field. After a recently released prisoner confesses to the murder of a 5-year-old boy 25 years previously, the team becomes suspicious of his motives and take a closer look at the boy's estranged parents. If you like TV errors, 11:05 p.m. is the time for you, with It'll Be All Right on the Night. David Walliams presents more embarrassing moments, like when James Martin discovered that live TV can be a recipe for disaster. Finally, to Friday, the 26th of November. Father Brown is on the Drama Channel at 8. When a tortured artist is murdered, Father Brown must discover who committed the crime before it's too late. Doc Martin is on ITV3 at 8 with two episodes. First is City Slickers. Louisa has new annoying neighbours. Then at 9 in The Admirer, Louisa faces off love rival Carrie and romance is in the air for Aunt Joan as she gains an admirer. Also at 8, but on BBC Two, is The Wild Gardener. In this, the second part of a two-part series, Colin Stafford Johnson begins to reap the rewards of his labours. The wildlife cameraman reflects on his journey so far and plans the busy spring and summer to come. Finally, at 8, there's the second part of Griff's Great New Zealand Adventure. Griff flies over Auckland's numerous extinct volcanoes before heading to the ever-expanding White Island volcano, the newest piece of land on the planet. At Lake Taupo, he discovers an upside to thermal activity, an endless stream of steam that can be used to generate electricity. It's the third quarter-final of MasterChef The Professionals on BBC One at 8:30 p.m. The four chefs are challenged to create a dish where colour is key. Next, they have an hour and 15 minutes to deliver a two-course meal for critics Grace Dent, Jay Rayner and Tom Parker Bowles. The two most talented chefs will make it through to the semi-finals. There's another edition of New Tricks at 10 on the Drama Channel in Dark Chocolate. The team go after a serial rapist after a recent assault at a bakery is linked to two attacks a decade earlier. I hope you find something of interest in my selection this week.
TNF Soundings.
Hello everyone, this is 10 Today, a 10-minute set of exercises to do at home to help keep yourself active. Before we get to today's presenter, a couple of housekeeping points to note. The 10 Today project is funded by the Big Lottery and Sport England, and when you're doing the exercises, it's important that you don't push yourself too far, and by taking part, you agree to 10 Today's terms and conditions. You can read these terms and conditions at tnflink.uk/10T, and the 10T is the digit 1, the digit 0, and the letter T. And please remember that you agree to take part at your own risk. Today's exercises are brought to you by Jeff, and here he is.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to 10 Today, broadcast number 3, where we focus on stretching. This is a short 10-minute physical activity routine which will get you moving and stretching. It's great for your health, including improving your balance and building up your strength. Just take it at your own pace. There's plenty of options. If an exercise feels too much, just take it easy and have a break. All the exercises can be done either standing up or sitting down. Just do whatever feels good for you today. We want you all to do the exercise safely. You are responsible for monitoring how you are feeling throughout the session. If you feel any discomfort or pain, if you feel unwell or dizzy or experience palpitations, then please stop and seek medical advice. Please remember, you agree to take part at your own risk. If remaining seated, at least to begin with, it would be a good idea if you can use a hard chair that you can sit upright in, preferably without arms, which can get in the way of some exercises. With your feet flat on the floor, if you are standing up, just step your feet hip width apart, relax your shoulders and stand up nice and tall, and take a couple of deep breaths. If you're sitting down, place both feet firmly on the floor, keep your back straight, relax your shoulders and take a couple of deep breaths. In and out. In and out. So, we're going to start with calf stretch. So, if you're standing, have your feet facing forward and step your right foot out in front of you with your foot flat on the floor. And then bend into the right leg, keeping your other leg straight. Put your hands on your right thigh and hold this position, feeling that stretch in your other leg. If you're sitting, straighten out your right leg and place your heel on the floor so your toes are pointing upwards. Keep your left leg bent with your foot flat on the floor and put your hands on your right thigh and lean forward. You should feel that nice stretch in your straight leg. The important thing about stretching is that when you feel the muscle starts to stretch, just hold it there. Don't take it any further. So hold that stretch for 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Now we're going to swap legs. If you're standing with your feet facing forward, step forward with your left leg and bend into that left leg, keeping your other leg straight. The weight should be on the left foot. And if you're sitting, straighten out the left leg and put your heel on the floor and your toes pointing up, and then keep your right leg bent. Put your hands on your bent thigh and lean your chest slightly forward into the stretch. You should feel a nice stretch in your straight leg. Hold for 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Next, we're going to do a hamstring stretch. Feet facing forward, step forward with your right foot, placing your foot out in front of you with your foot flat on the floor. Keep this leg straight. Then bend your left leg and put your hands on your hips and just lean the chest forward gently. Remember to keep your back straight. Whether you're sitting or standing, you should feel a nice stretch down the back of your leg. Hold for 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Then return to an upright position and swap your legs. So this time, step forward with your left foot, placing your foot out in front of you. With your foot flat on the floor, then bend your right leg and just lean forward gently. Again, that nice long stretch. Hold for 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Next up, we have a few head and neck stretches. Starting with the head tilt forward, tilt your head gently forward, as if you're nodding, nice and slowly, and then return upright. Just do that a couple more times. So, nodding nice and slowly downwards, return upright. Keep going slowly so that you feel a nice stretch in your neck. And the final neck stretch, head rotation. Turn your head to the right slowly, as if you're looking over your right shoulder. Then return to the middle. Then return your head left slowly, as if you're looking over your left shoulder. And just keep going, looking from left to right, slowly feeling that nice stretch in your neck. So for the next one, bend your right arm and bend it over your head so your hand is touching your back, like you're scratching your back, and your elbow is next to your ear. With your other hand, press gently on your elbow and feel that nice stretch in your arm. Hold for 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, then release. Then do the same on the other side. So, bending your arm over your head, with your hand on your back, and placing the other hand on your elbow and pressing gently, feeling that nice stretch down your arm. Hold for 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Now we have the side stretch. Stand or sit up tall, raise your right arm high with your palm facing up. Then lean slightly over to your left side, nicely and slowly, feeling that stretch all along your right side. Try to keep your body straight and hold for 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Now return back to the centre. Lean your left hand over, feel that stretch all the way down to your left side, and hold for 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. So the next one is chest stretch. So open out both your arms to the side so that your chest sticks out a little and you can feel a nice stretch all the way across your chest. Just a little bit, like a long lost friend coming towards you, you're going to give them a big hug. So keep your arms open, wide, feeling that stretch across your chest. Keep holding it there for 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Next up is trunk rotation. What we mean by trunk is your upper body. Stand or sit up, tall, straight back. Place your hands on your hips and slowly look to your left, feeling your upper body rotate, so bring the right shoulder in front and return gently to the centre. And then slowly look to your right, bringing the left shoulder in front, feeling your upper body rotate. Again, we're going to do a few more times, nice and slowly. Great work. If you're standing, remember to keep your knees soft. And the final stretch, hugging a tree. Just hold your arms out in front of you, just like you're hugging a tree, directly in front of you. Your arms from nice circle in front of you, and then cup your hands, putting one hand in front of the other, and push your hands together, feeling that nice stretch across the shoulders and arms. Hold for 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Now sit up or stand up and return to that nice relaxed posture we had at the beginning. Brilliant! So that's the end of the stretching session. I hope you feel loose and revitalized. Just to finish off, shake it out. Just shake those arms and hands and legs and feet Great work, everyone. Doing 10 today, just 3 times a week, can have great health benefits. It's fun and you'll simply feel better. So do keep going. Thanks for listening.
TNS Soundings.
This is Rupert Evershed reading my monthly nature notes for the Hearts Ad. Our local wildlife needs your voice. When writing my monthly nature notes, I'm usually deliberately upbeat. I'm a firm believer that if we love something, we will fight for it and be motivated to protect it. There are occasions, however, when even I, trying as I may to stay positive, feel the weight of encroaching problems and the closing in of the world I enjoy. For some time now, heavy storm clouds have hung on the horizon of Tittenhanger Gravel Pits, a place I love and enjoy weekly. They are not literal clouds, but metaphorical, and began to cast a long shadow over the area as far back as 2017 with the publishing of Hartsmere Borough Council's vision for the future of housing development. Now those heavy clouds sit right over the site with Hartsmere's recently published draft local plan for development, making the site the centrepiece of its proposals. A new village starting with 6,000 new homes but growing to possibly 12,000 in the future. Bowman's Cross will straddle the space between London Coney and Coney Heath, removing any vestiges of Greenbelt and swallowing these existing villages in a vast conurbation. The sheer scale of the proposals is shocking, and if approved will remove an area of countryside rich in wildlife and enjoyed by many local people. For Hartsmere Borough Council, it is a masterstroke, with most of these local people not living in their borough, but in the neighbouring St Albans Borough. Despite pressure to publicise their proposals more widely, many local residents remain unaware of Hartsmere's intentions. Successive lockdowns over the last year have made the area even more valued by local walkers, cyclists and horse riders. A new Facebook page focusing on the enjoyment of wildlife at the site has now over 400 members, with many expressing their initial surprise and wonder at the richness of the wildlife on offer. It is a place that you cannot help but notice the wildlife, whether it is the nesting grey herons, the summer kaleidoscope of butterflies, or the hawking hobbies that feed off the plentiful supply of dragonflies. Winter brings flocks of thrushes, gulls and wildfowl, ensuring that even the dullest day is enlivened with activity, and possibly the drama of a hunting peregrine or fox. The site is not just for our entertainment though, and represents an important and valuable ecology, supporting the very last breeding tree sparrows in the southeast of England. These rare birds have clung on thanks to habitat protection and year-round feeding and monitoring by the Hearts Bird Club. Now their world is threatened, and along with them over 200 other species of birds, many of which are themselves endangered. Aside from the sadness caused by the very real possibility of one of Hertfordshire's best sites for wildlife being lost, comes the deeper sadness, perhaps verging on despair, that this is yet another loss for wildlife. The plight of our planet, the shifting climate, and the rapid demise of so much of our wildlife is rarely out of the news, and yet the kind of systemic change needed is still awaited. Wildlife is still seen as expendable, and the loss of biodiversity something that can, in the words of the National Planning Policy Framework, be compensated for or mitigated. But underlying the compensation and mitigation strategies is the assumption of loss. No amount of compensation or mitigation can replace, for example, a single 100-year-old oak tree and the 2,300 species it supports. It is easy to despair, and the danger is that this leads to inaction. Instead, it is important to make our voices heard, and particularly at this time, when the future of the Tittenhanger area hangs in the balance. Hartsmere's draft local plan is open for public consultation until the 6th of December 2021, giving anyone the opportunity to object and comment. It is a very real and powerful way to stand up for nature, something that is not just relevant to residents of Hartsmere, but to everyone, everywhere. This level of development, especially on Greenbelt land, is unsustainable, and if areas of wide open space, rich in wildlife, are needed now, how much more so for future generations?
Hello. This article is called The Flamboyant Farmhouse. Home to fleeing Flemish aristocrats, a world-changing agricultural scientist, and a celebrated sculptor, stunning Rothamsted Manor in Harpenden is now opening up to the public. The words are by Gillian Thornton. In wooded farmland on the edge of Harpenden, Rothamsted Manor was the home of Sir John Bennett Lawes, 19th century scientist and founder of what is today's Rothamsted Research, one of the oldest agricultural research institutions in the world. His pioneering experiments into fertilizers and crop nutrition on the estate continue to influence farming around the globe, and his impressive red brick mansion, visible on the walking trail that winds around the estate and takes in the new high-tech Rothamsted Research Centre, is an elegant reminder of where it all began. The old manor is full of surprises. For a start, it's not all about Sir John. I'm standing in front of some seriously snazzy leather wallpaper, lavishly embellished with exotic birds and flowers, and I've just enjoyed a privileged look at some rare 16th century wall paintings hidden away for centuries behind wood panelling. For many years, this eye-catching property was rarely open to visitors, but now a growing programme of public and private functions is enabling more people to see behind the leaded windows. Ticketed events include scrumptious afternoon teas and stirring musical evenings, heritage open days and Christmas parties. The manor is also available to hire for weddings and other celebrations. As the party season approaches, there can be few more atmospheric venues in the county. I soon find that Sir John wasn't the first to make his mark here. As I step through the front door, I pass beneath a coat of arms showing a bohemian-looking gentleman with a bandana and flowing beard. Underneath him is a line of what looks like three V's, but is in fact a pair of W's, the emblem of the Witteronge family, who purchased the property in 1623. The original Rothamsted, first recorded in 1212, was probably a simple open hall, but a line drawing from the 1623 conveyance to Anne Witteronge shows a small gabled manor house. Anne was a wealthy widow, the daughter-in-law of Jacques Witteronge of Ghent, who moved to London in 1564 to escape the religious persecution of Flemish Protestants. Her son John was just 5 when she bought Rothamsted on his behalf. In 1641, newly knighted by Charles I, John set about transforming the modest country house into a Jacobean manor with Flemish gables. And of course, subsequent owners had their own design ideas too. The 17th century hall flagstones were covered with 19th century oak, and that vibrant 16th century mural in the lounge was hidden from view. Believed to depict the 1573 Siege of Edinburgh, it features knights on sturdy war horses and cannons belching smoke. The scene is above a frieze of rather portly-looking big cats and hunting dogs. When the last of the Witterongs died childless in 1763, the manor passed to a cousin, John Bennett, and on his death to his nephew, John Bennett Lawes, not the one that most of us associate with the property. The first JBL was a friend of the Prince Regent, spending so much on his London lifestyle that to pay his bills he had to rent out the manor and move with his wife and son, John, the future scientist, into the much less grand Rothamsted Lodge. JBL Jr. was just 8 when he inherited the manor in 1822. Educated at Eton, he was academically unimpressive, leaving Oxford without a degree. But he always loved chemistry, and in 1834, when he moved into the manor to run the farm, he set up a laboratory in a bedroom, an act, he said, seriously disturbed the peace of mind of my mother. His success in patenting and manufacturing fertilizers led to a profitable business and a partnership with chemist Joseph Henry Gilbert, that was to last 57 years. In 1843, they planted the first of what were to become the Rothamsted long-term experiments on Broad Bulk Field. The smallest experiment, a patch of red clover in the Manor Gardens, has been growing continuously since 1854. As Sir John's wealth grew, he spent money on the welfare of his workers and made philanthropic gifts to the people of Harpenden. And he spent money on his home. In 1864, he added the great drawing room to host a birthday ball for his 21-year-old son Charles, even buying a dance floor from a former Lord Chamberlain that had been trodden on by Queen Victoria. Laws and Gilbert loved showing their scientific work to visitors from across the globe, and many were hosted to tea at the manor. After Sir John's death in 1900, Charles began his own major alterations at considerable expense. A talented athlete, he was a Blue for Cambridge in rowing and running, and a celebrated sculptor with 12 works exhibited at the Royal Academy. He remodelled the ballroom in 1900, raising the ceiling, replacing the Victorian windows, and adding modern rectangular panelling, only to replace it again 6 years later with the linen fold panelling we see today. He installed the lavish wall coverings that caught my eye in the Spanish leather room, and added a library modelled on Rawdon House in Hoddesdon, which had recently been converted to a convent. Wander through the downstairs reception rooms and you'll find lavish touches everywhere. Flamboyant fireplaces, moulded plaster ceilings, a glazed loggia with checkerboard floor, and in every room, reminders of the Witterongs and their descendants in coats of arms, stained glass and family portraits. In 1902, Charles made perhaps his greatest compliment to his Flemish ancestors, becoming Sir Charles Lawes Witterong. He died in 1911, but a century on, his presence at Rothamsted is still very evident, not just in the house, but in his monumental marble sculpture, The Death of Dursey, positioned at the end of a tree-lined avenue. The original bronze stands outside the entrance to Tate Britain. A smaller marble statue of a bather stands in the yew lawn. Charles' son John settled in Australia, and on his death in 1931, the family put the property on the market. In 1934, Rothamsted Manor was bought by the Lawes Agricultural Trust, and after being requisitioned for military use in World War I, the upstairs was converted to accommodation for staff and visiting scientists. But downstairs, thanks to its growing event programme, the wood panelling echoes once more to the sounds of people having fun, the clink of glasses, the ripple of laughter, and the music of a new generation. One feels sure its previous owners would heartily approve. And the article is illustrated with some great photographs of this wonderful house and gardens.
Hello, I'm Sue. This article is from Hertfordshire Life, and it's called Growing New Connections. With the Climate Change Committee calling for the planting of 160,000 miles of it, the humble hedgerow could return to pre-World War II levels and create a healthier and more biodiverse landscape. The words are by Liz Hamilton, CPRE, the Countryside Charity. It may surprise you to learn that the icon of Britain's countryside, its hedgerows, almost certainly have their origins in the Neolithic. This was the period around 6,000 years ago when hunter-gathering was replaced with farming. Hedges in that period may have originated from leftover pieces of cleared woodland, managed to be livestock-proof. Oliver Rackham's book, The History of the Countryside, cites evidence of hedgerow's establishment over many centuries, while the great wave of planting that accompanied the 18th and 19th century enclosures added 200,000 miles of hedges to the British countryside. In the UK since 1945, we have lost around half an estimated 400,000 miles of our hedges. They were in the way of ever larger machinery and too difficult or too expensive to maintain traditionally. Perhaps 60% of the remaining hedges are in poor condition, often thin and full of gaps. A thick, tall, well-managed hedge is a hugely valuable resource for wildlife, and its value increases if land alongside is maintained for wildlife too. Hedges also benefit humans. As well as providing forage and fuel, they lift the spirits, whether seen through a window or from a garden, or while travelling or walking. A healthy hedge will harbour birds, which often fly up and move a little ahead if you walk nearby, keeping you company on your way. Hedges and their associated soils absorb and retain carbon from the atmosphere as their vegetation grows and decays. For this reason, as part of its programme for the UK to meet its net zero carbon target by 2050, the Climate Change Committee has recommended that the extent of hedges in the UK should be extended by 40%, approximately 160,000 miles. Campaign to Protect Rural England has launched a national campaign to promote this target and is calling on the government to produce a funded plan for its achievement, although to date there has been no specific government announcement. New research published by CPRE in September suggests that an increase in the UK's hedge network of this magnitude, as well as absorbing large volumes of carbon and increasing biodiversity, would help prevent flash flooding and soil erosion and provide a variety of economic benefits. The report, Hedge Fund, Investing in Hedgerows for Climate, Nature and the Economy, is the result of research carried out for CPRE independently by the Organic Research Centre. An estimated 25,000 jobs associated with planting and managing hedges could be created. The report also suggests that for every £1 invested in hedge planting and management, economic benefits worth £1.73 would be generated for farmers due to increased crop yields and reduced pesticide use due to increased pollinators and predators. We regard hedges as barriers and as boundaries, but they're also corridors and links too. For many species, including birds, bats and newts, they are a vital aid, helping them to navigate between roosting, breeding and feeding places. Hedge Fund cites the example of marsh tits, a declining species in the UK. A study of young birds in East Anglia found they struggle to move between woods more than 200 metres apart unless they are connected by hedges. Loss of an associated marsh tit's habitat might wipe out the species entirely in a locality, whereas well-connected networks of woods and hedges might help reverse the decline of these birds. With climate warming comes heavier rainfall, causing flash flooding and soil erosion. Hedges and trees slow down, trap and filter runoff. Studies in the Pontbren catchment in Wales showed a 40% reduction in flood peaks where tree strips had been placed across hillsides. In Brittany, banked hedges were found to reduce peak flows in an adjoining stream by between 25 and 50%. Hedges traversing hillsides also trap soil and valuable nutrients. In urban areas, hedges are more effective than bare trunk trees at reducing noise impacts and capturing pollution. Planting hedges alongside roads is likely to have valuable health benefits and result in savings for health service providers. CPRE is also calling on the government to reform the hedgerow regulations introduced in 1997, which allow for hedges over 20 metres in length to be protected if they are of archaeological, historical, wildlife or landscape value. Now that the value of all hedges is more fully appreciated, they should be protected at all costs. A recently published children's book, The Happy Hedgerow, by Hertfordshire-based author Eleanor Mannion, featured as Book of the Season in this summer's issue of Countryside Voices, CPR's member magazine. Beautifully illustrated by Erin Brown, the book tells the story of a hedgerow whose declining fortunes are reversed when a new landowner reinstates a bulldozed section. In endorsing the book, CPRE Vice President Sir Andrew Motion said the book is a welcome reminder that hedgerows are our greatest nature reserves, which will encourage children to engage with the rich variety of life on their doorsteps. Suitable for age 4 upwards, the text and illustrations vividly depict many species found in and around hedges and the changing seasons. I met Eleanor at her village home, where she runs a publishing company specialising in books for children. Having spent much of her career in publishing, this is the first children's book she has published which she has written herself. She said her inspiration came during lockdown. I walked more and saw the large prairie fields near my village. Lots of local green spaces have gone, as farmland is built on, and I remembered seeing hedges disappear when I was growing up in Hertfordshire. She talked about her passion for storytelling and for connecting children to nature, hoping that as adults they will feel empowered to do more to protect their disappearing countryside and its wildlife. As we shared memories of the books we read to our children, she added, "Pictures are so important, as they will help with interpretation of the words telling the story." In her book, Old Oak worries what will happen to the creatures living in the bulldozed hedge, and watches in dismay as heavy rain and high winds erode the soil, something that had never happened when the far hedgerow was there. The book ends on a happy note, as people arrive to replant the hedge, which communities everywhere can also do. This would give adults and children opportunities to make a contribution to tackling climate change. Hedges could be reinstated, evidenced by old photos, maps, and written accounts. New locations would make new connections, enhance fields, roadsides, and paths, and bring biodiversity to new places. CPRE nationally is planning research next year to identify sites for the new hedges, to deliver benefits for communities in both urban and rural places. You can find out more about how to get involved at cpre.org.uk.
We're nearing the end of this week's programme. It just remains for me to thank our contributors Caroline, Ian, Elizabeth, Sarah and Sue, and of course John Cushing for the radio listings, John Barker for the audio described TV listings, and Rupert Evershed for Nature Notes. Next week, Steve will be here with News Extra, but that's all from me in November 2021. We close with Fenland by Granny's Attic. I do hope you enjoy it. Goodbye for now, and stay safe.